This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Brent Lynn from Hawke's Bay, and you are the CEO of the local Wine Growers Association.
Yeah, that's right. Lovely to be here, Chris.
Loving it. And we're in lovely sunny Hawke's Bay, Hastings in actual fact. And again, it's stinking hot, and I've had to turn the air conditioning off in this room so we don't have the motor running for the recording, but it's warming up.
It is warming up indeed.
What I want to talk about today is I want to talk a wee bit about some of the issues with the region and what's been going on with various things. But one of the things I've noticed is that Hawke's Bay has become one of the wine capitals of the world. And that was about, what, 3-4 years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, 2023,
yeah. So do you want to tell us what it is and what it means?
So the Great Wine Capitals Network is a network of cities that have joined together to recognise excellence in wine tourism and production. So these are all regions that have not just established pedigree with the production of wines, but also have a developed and rich tourism, wine tourism industry, aligned with also a wine educational institute, and aligned with the provincial government's recognition of the importance of the wine industry to the region. So they all share that sort of founding.
So you got places like Stellenbosch, Napa, is Rioja one of them?
I think Rioja is one of them. There's 11 other capitals, so including Napa, Adelaide in South Australia, Verona, Porto, but they're all sort of established around that premise that they have a multiply tiered offering wines and also tourism experiences.
You mentioned education. What is the educational institution here in Hawke's Bay?
So here we have the Eastern Institute of Technology Wine School, which has been operating in the region for many years, and many of the region's talented winemakers that are alumni of that institution.
Nice.
And it's also has an extensive program with offshore students coming into Hawke's Bay to study wine here.
Let's talk a wee bit about your export industry or importing or whatever it is. Hawke's Bay produces a number of different styles of wine. I think last week we talked about just under a quarter is Chardonnay, a quarter is Sauvignon Blanc, a quarter is red, and then a quarter is mixed. Yeah, everything else. What is exported and where does it go?
So for Hawke's Bay, we have a very different export profile to wine New Zealand. Of the New Zealand production, 90% of it's exported. If we look at it regionally for Hawke's Bay, those numbers are around 25% export and 75% domestic consumption. Mm. And the major export markets are obviously, one's driven by geographic influence, which is Australia, which is just across the ditch, but importantly, the US and the UK, and then Canada, and then Ireland. Strange bedfellows. I think that's all around more sort of driven by natural alignments and relationships that have been built up over time.
Okay, and you're saying earlier that Sauvignon Blanc in particular from Hawke's Bay is being targeted at the US market. Is there any other particular varietals that are really key for export?
Chardonnay. Chardonnay is sort of the poster child for Hawke's Bay exports in its myriad of styles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the worldwide interest in Chardonnay wines, we're well placed to capitalise on that interest. And it sits in a difference demographic to, say, the Chardonnays from Burgundy and the Chardonnays from Napa, in which they basically line up against.
The climate seems to be between Burgundy and Napa anyway, from what I can tell. Napa's a little bit warmer, maybe not Los Caneros, but further up the valley certainly, and then Burgundy is cooler. So you've got that, so you're sitting climatically in the middle there as well.
Yeah.
which gives you something a little bit different, a little bit different. One of the things I noticed when I was talking to Mark Thompson and Gisborne was that he was saying that there was a little bit of an oversupply in Gisborne, and that about 100,000 tonnes of grapes throughout New Zealand weren't picked last year. They were just left on the vine. And
we've had a roller coaster with vintage size. So 23 was the cyclone year. We were only somewhat down on our normal annual 40,000 tonne of production from Hawke's Bay. The following year was the tail of cyclone in terms of that very long extended cooler summer, which meant that we had poor bud initiation, and we were 27% down on our long run average in 24. In the flowering period of that vintage, if we have unsettled weather there, then our success of pollination is compromised. 25 vintage, we haven't got the final numbers, but you know, long run, we're around sort of nearly back to that 40,000 tonnes. But it was a very fruitful vintage. There was fruit left behind in the 25 vintage as a response to market demand for, and producers making informed decisions around what their sales projections will be. Even if you're talking a red wine and you're talking 2 years out, you need to know that if you harvest it and make it, that you will be able to sell it. And sometimes the correct decision is to say, we will leave this fruit behind because we have got to the yield that we need to meet our sales projections. Mm. There was fruit left behind in 25, and we see the same thing in the 26 vintage, where growers are making informed decisions about how much they'll crop, so they self-imposed yield limits, and also if they have oversupply in their portfolio, one varietal, they may look at holding that block in a non-production state for a year and then returning to the market.
I saw when we were driving up towards Gimlet Gravels, just before Gimlet Gravels, there was one vineyard and it was all trellised up, everything's, there's no, it wasn't green at all. Yeah. It was like it was in dormant stage.
So it may be a grower that's looked at the varietal in that block and decided that his portfolio is overbalanced in that varietal. He may be waiting for planting material to be available, because that's normally a 12-month lead time with grafted grapevines being available for planting. So he may have elected to put the vineyard in to sleep.
And how do you do that? Is that just a spray?
No spray. So those vines will be cut off.
Hack them off.
The vine will keep growing. The vine will continue to push out from that base, right? So they have the option of grafting onto that base stock,
yeah,
right? Or they may remove the whole infrastructure and re-trellis the
vineyard.
More modern trellis, more closer spacing, subsurface irrigation. They may look at all those improvements, but it may just be capital and time at this point, which is determined that we're just going to hold this for the time. We're going to preserve the asset, but we're not going to put in the high input costs of it.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense as well. Particularly if it's a good time if you want to change crops.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got the wrong mix and you're worried about that. One of the vineyards, Tiawanga Estates, went into liquidation recently, and we saw that up in Milton as well. Is it hard to shift vineyards at the moment? I'm seeing two estates that have now gone into liquidation rather than being bought up and as a going concern.
Can't really comment on individual businesses. What I can observe is over time we live in a cyclical industry and we are experiencing one of those cycles. I guess without the strength of a balance sheet to see you through one of those cycles, there are some difficult decisions that businesses have had to make. Mm-hmm. In terms of the desire for vineyard acquisition by third parties, we're seeing the same caution in terms of the buyer community, but equally an investor would look at it as, if it's cyclical, when's the best time that I should be buying a vineyard? Is it top of the demand cycle or is some other point?
And also there's the opportunity as well that Hawke's Bay is produces a lot of different product. It's not just vineyards, there's a lot of different citrus and stone fruit that's produced. So the moving to another type of crop might be suitable.
So land use versatility is a real thing. And I think that you'll see that each land use has its pros and its cons.
Mm-hmm.
And time is a great washer over of the cycles of those respective industries.
Other fruit crops, are they in boom at the moment?
We are seeing in Hawke's Bay, apples have been a rapid growth in the plantings of apples, not at the expense of any vineyard. It's typically been new cropping land. That's
New Zealand's has pushed and have been well at getting sustainability. Most vineyards in New Zealand are now classed by New Zealand Science as sustainable.
So sustainable wine growing New Zealand, which was really the first industry accreditation scheme in New Zealand, mm-hmm. run by industry for industry to give assurance about the sustainable practices of production of wine,
mm-hmm.
and both vineyards and wineries registered as sustainable. It's an opt-in, you don't need to belong. I think nationally it's around 98% or something of area is subject to a sustainability program. But then, you know, we also have equivalency with some of the other sustainability models, such as BioGrow certified, Dermata, and even I think we've got a couple of ISO accredited vineyards who recognise the importance of having a documented sustainability program that can be audited and proven. Those outside of the sustainability program are equally committed to producing sustainable wines, but they just don't have that documentation.
One of the things we're seeing around the rest of the world is regenerative viticulture as a movement, and there are now certification processes for regen. Are we seeing any of that in New Zealand?
Yeah, we are seeing an interest in regen. Probably the first challenge is going to be describe what regenerative viticulture is, because we're very familiar with it in a pastoral sense, and we see that operating a lot in our pastoral farming community. But what does it mean on a vineyard? We see all different interpretations of what that looks like, and the crossover between that and organic or biodynamic is an interesting a meeting pot. But to answer your question, we have an active and engaged community that are looking at all of these sort of sustainability benchmarks, not just as a marketing tool, but as a belief in terms of being good custodians of the land.
Do you think the SWINS, the Sustainable Wine New Zealand, would expand its interpretation of sustainability to include some of those regenerative practices? For example, tilling the soil used to be very common in organics, but it's completely bad from a regenerative point of view. Are you seeing those sort of things being encouraged into the vineyard?
Where will regenerative viticulture as an accreditation scheme sit? First of all, there needs to be an organisation that is Regenerative Viticulture New Zealand Inc. that can identify what the standards are and then can develop the protocols as Organic New Zealand has done for organic production and as has Dermata for, you know.
But Dermata is a French organisation, so you could just take, for example, there is a number of viticultural standards for regenerative viticulture out there that are being used around the world in different places, so you could just adopt those standards.
You could, and then like with Dermata and BioGrow, you would seek equivalency with SWINS sustainability registration. Those two have achieved, and so I'm sure if there are industry audited sustainability programs, they could achieve equivalency.
Okay, and last question for you, a little bit of a tricky one. In the EU at the moment, in particular, there's a real push to reduce the number of chemicals applied on vineyards, and what you're seeing is different chemicals being removed from the toolkit that you're allowed to use. The idea is to encourage different methods of weed control, pest control, mold, mildew control. Is that something that's happening in New Zealand as well, or has the government, it just sort of doesn't go around down that road too much?
No, we have a very regulated spray schedule, and each year we see the removal of certain compounds or certain timings of application from that spray schedule. This has been balanced by a much heightened focus on the impact of actually viticultural practices around canopy management, because most of our disease issues are associated with canopy management, with the exception of perhaps grape leaf roller virus, right?
Oh, yeah.
And mealybug is the vector. But most of the main diseases of grapevines in New Zealand are the odiums, the downy and powdery mildew, associated botrytis risk that's connected with those. So we see a lot of work being done by our viddies on active canopy management, shoot thinning, leaf plucking, leaf ratio analysis, so that we're just at the borderline of how much compact foliage we require to produce the fruit vineyard is targeting. So that's probably more of an important development. We are going to continue to see a consumer interest in less and less applications of synthetic or even organic, for that matter, chemicals to what we consider to be a food. On the other side of it, we're getting much better at actually creating an environment that we do not need to rely on these tools.
All right then, I think we'll wrap it up there, Brent. Thank you very much for your time. It's been excellent.
Thank you for visiting Hawke's Bay. It's lovely to have visitors from the other side of the world. And, you know, we extend an offer to your listeners that next time you are purchasing some wine, look on down the list and see if you can see product of Hawke's Bay. And if not, ask why not.
Cheers very much.